This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. This is Frida Liu. You're listening to Her Vantage. In this way, we speak to women of influence and leadership. Catalyst is a global nonprofit working with some of the world's most powerful CEOs and leading companies around the world to help build workplaces that work for women. Founded in 1962, Catalyst drives change with pioneering research, practical tools, and proven solutions to accelerate and advance women into leadership, because progress for women is progress for everyone. I'm here with Alison Zimmerman, Executive Director, Europe, Middle East, and Africa from Catalyst. So it's so good to be speaking to you again, Alison, after such a long period, right? And I think last we spoke, and I mean, since then, America has had a unique precedent. And then, of course, the pandemic that hasn't ended. You know, what has happened with the advancement or regression of women in the last 5 years? In a nutshell, if you could.
Well, it's nice to be here. Thank you, Frida, for having me. When we think of the last, you know, the past 5 years for women in particular, we can't forget the Me Too Time's Up movement.
Right.
It was a global outcry from women. And while it started in certain pockets and certain stories in the world, it tapped into something very global that women were saying enough, enough on multiple levels.
Right.
And then when we progress and we look over the last 5 years, we look in the last year, and we see the pandemic has amplified existing inequities, whether it be gender, race, ethnicity, but also socioeconomic inequities.
Right.
And the pandemic continues to highlight this. And so specifically when we look at when COVID happened, we see that women are most likely to be the single parents.
Right.
They have to choose during this pandemic between taking care of children and jobs. But they are also most likely to do all the childcare, home care. And this is global, that we see women, even if they are the main breadwinner, are also taking up more than their fair share of the domestic duties. And then on top of that, it just compounds when you see women are most likely to be the essential workers. They're making less money than men, average 20 cents. If I think of the euro, 20 cents less than men in the euro. And I mean, $20 less than men. It would be lovely if it were only 20 cents women, 20 cents to every euro.
Right.
Yeah.
And you know, and I think of Catalyst, right? Next year, you'll be celebrating 60 years in existence, right? An organization that does this. And it's good that, you know, there's an organization that's so, but it's kind of sad that we're still having this sort of discussion 60 years on.
Yeah.
Right? And one of the things that caught my attention on your site was cultural sensitivity in global workplaces. Now, before we get into specifics, because it's so interesting coming from Malaysia, is cultural sensitivity a women's issue or people in general?
Well, first of all, it's people in general. When you think about it, cultural sensitivity, we all live in different cultures, different contexts, different experience in the global workplace. So the cultural sensitivity wasn't specific to women, you know, something we've been looking at. It's specific to people in general, especially when we saw what happened with George Floyd in the United States and the murder. And while that happened in the United States, it also, we can't forget from this time that this just amplified inequities, definitely in race, ethnicity, globally. And so while the global context is different, and you know, you're in Malaysia and it's different in your context, what we see is that workplaces are global.
Right.
And so it's really being aware, how is the workplace being experienced, whether it's on gender, race, ethnicity, socioeconomic difference? How are we experiencing it? And what kind of sensitivity do we have working in this global workplace? And so most of the examples we share, we have a Flip the Script that's available out there. Mm. It's really for people in general.
Right.
However, I'm sure there are more examples that apply to the comments and questions that women receive that men do not.
Right.
And so this can happen in some cultures more than others.
Right.
But clearly, women, when we look globally, they are being systematically disadvantaged more than men in the workplace.
Right. How has cultural sensitivity become more important as we're online communicating with colleagues around the world? And I guess there's less face-to-face, we're not traveling anymore. How is this a lot more important because of this online communication?
Yeah, well, first of all, there's so much fear of what people are saying. And there's so much fear like, oh, if I say this, are they going to think this? Especially now. And this is not about being quote unquote politically correct. This is just being more understanding about how others might receive some communications and how they can feel not included. They can feel excluded. And so when we talk about cultural sensitivity, right now that we are online communicating with colleagues around the world, to your question, it is so important because here's the challenge. Oftentimes we do not talk because we're afraid to say the wrong thing.
Right.
But if we don't talk and we're afraid to say the wrong thing, what you're going to hear in the culture is there's no issue. There's no challenge. I'm not hearing about this. And we hear this all the time when we do workshops, when we work with companies and leaders. We will hear how afraid they are to make a mistake. And so this might tie into further discussion. You have more questions, but I would say that you have to be even more careful when you're online, because not only most of us go on video, we can see how you're reacting, you know, versus being on the phone.
Right.
And in the same breath, when you're in an office, it can be a different experience versus when you're online. So being aware that most of us, not everybody, but many of us, whatever industry you're in, we will come into contact with people from around the world. And that's a benefit. But we want to make sure that we understand how things might be received differently.
You know, and like you were saying, well, I was saying, sometimes it feels like walking on eggshells before we open our mouths, right? And I guess, how can we get over ourselves so that we don't get too nervous, because communication is important?
Absolutely. And I love this question, because first of all, you're not going to get it always right. And that may feel really uncomfortable to hear, but I don't get it always right. I'm a human being. I sometimes have opened my mouth and I've said things. I'm like, oh my goodness, could I take that back? And I want to hide. But the reality is it's not about being perfect.
Right.
It's about showing progress.
Right.
So let's say you feel like you're walking on eggshells and you want to kind of get over that, so you're not as nervous. First of all, say something such as, you know, I'm really uncomfortable asking this, or I'm not sure if this is appropriate, or I'm going to use a bit of courage here because I'm feeling a little nervous acting. If you simply state how you're feeling, people will be a little more, they will be more aware that that was difficult for you, or they'll be aware that you're taking a risk. And it's interesting, when we did research on what made people feel included, it was really people who took risks. For example, if a leader took a risk, the outcome, you know, there were other factors, but one of them was having psychological safety that you could take a risk, that you could say something.
Right.
I think to make it very simple, the more you can show your humanity and simply being a human to others, they will react usually in kind.
Right.
Because what you'll tap into is what their humanity or their what makes them human. And so I think let's not freeze up.
Right.
Let's call it what we're feeling.
Right. And I like what you said. You know, it's not perfection, it's progress. And I think that's important when we go there, like, you know, so I never knew this, you know, I just want to understand that sort of thing. And I think people will understand your intention if you're really coming from a humane place, if and you put it out there. Great. I'm here with Alison Zimmerman from Catalyst.org. Stay tuned to our conversation right here on Her Vantage Enterprise, BFM 89.9.
Backing feminist movements. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Her Vantage, and this way we speak to women of influence and leadership. I'm here with Alison Zimmerman from Catalyst.org, and Catalyst has been around since 1962, global nonprofit working with some of the world's most powerful CEOs and leading companies around the world to help build workplaces that work for women. Our conversation today is on cultural sensitivity in global workplaces, and it's a very interesting conversation that we're having. I was looking at the infographics that you have on your website, but I just want to go through a couple of scenarios. Let's say you hear someone with a different accent and you can't understand what the person is saying, right? What's the right thing to do and say in that situation? And we're always on these calls now.
Yeah, well, it's hard sometimes. You know, you hear somebody with a different accent and you don't want to ask them to repeat what they said because you kind of want to brush over and go over it, but you might be missing something really important. Right. And also by ignoring what they're saying, you kind of are unconsciously ignoring them in a way by just kind of dismissing. And the question you should ask is, who am I making this comfortable for? Me. If I have to say, you know, if I brush over, I'm uncomfortable to ask you. So what's the right thing to do and say? Ask them to repeat what they said first. Say, I'm sorry, I didn't hear. Could you please repeat? I speak German and, you know, I'm Swiss and American, but I still have a very heavy American accent. And I try, honestly, I try, but I know, like, I'm going to go to my grave. Not I'm going to have that American, heavy American accent when I speak. But sometimes I notice it's difficult to living in the culture where I do. They will say, excuse me. And I'll say, I'm so sorry. And I'll slow down. And I'll say it. Sometimes I'll spell it out. Sometimes I'll write it down, which is uncomfortable, let's be honest. But I am grateful when they are putting forth the effort to say, hey, I'm, you know, could you say, or I didn't understand. And then usually a second person jumps in if you're in a group, and don't hesitate to jump in and reiterate, you know, if it's appropriate in that setting, because it's really on the person who's not understanding to ask to repeat it. And say, I'm sorry. And even if you do it a couple times, and it may be uncomfortable, and it may be, but you genuinely want to hear what they have to say. And you could, you know, I often say, I'm so sorry, my hearing isn't great sometimes. and it really isn't sometimes. So it's being human again in another way, but also not ignoring it, not ignoring a person because you don't understand them.
Okay, what if you're curious about that person's nationality? What's the polite way of asking? Should you even ask?
Why not? You can ask somebody's nationality. So, you know, I live in Europe and oftentimes this is how we connect. So where are you from? You know, it's not bad to ask, where are you from? It's not bad to ask, where do you call home? That's a polite way many people will go, especially if they're inquiring about heritage. They will say, oh, where do you call home? But the challenge, there are two parts. First of all, nationality is fine. But when you ask, where are you from? The challenge comes in when you're asking the second time. So think about it this way. I ask, where are you from, Frida? And you answer. And then I ask, no, but where are you from? And so what I'm doing is I am denying your answer. And that may sound quite strong to say. But the second question, why that's problematic is, no, where are you really from? You are referencing the heritage. Now, This would not be appropriate in many cases, right, unless you know the person or unless you're using genuine curiosity, humility, and vulnerability to ask them. Also, if you're in similar cultures and you say, oh, but, you know, I get it every day where I meet someone new and they hear my accent and they're like, where are you from? No, but did you fly over from the U.S.? And probably every day I have to say, oh, actually, you know, I've lived as long in Europe as I've lived in the U.S. I'm American and Swiss. I've lived across four countries in the U.S. I do speak this language, blah, blah, blah. And where it can be problematic in this global workplace is maybe in your culture, it might be perfectly fine to say that.
Right.
But where it's problematic is somebody will feel like a perpetual foreigner, even if they are part of that country, they've lived there. And it's that, it's, you know, and exclusion doesn't happen.
Right.
It's in a bubble. It usually happens in moment by moment.
So I guess the thing is, you know, the person could be of this nationality, but same question, what would be your cultural heritage? Yeah. That sort of thing, right?
But you want to be cautious, especially like I think in Europe, if you're working, you want to be cautious and just throwing that out there as somebody you don't know or you don't have, let's say, a working relationship with.
Right.
But if you do, if you use genuine curiosity, humility, vulnerability, and you say, hey, I know, you know, you're from here and I'm just curious, how do you identify?
Right.
Or you have to be very, I can tell you, for example, you know, in my role overseeing EMEA, if you're going to Africa, you're going to be talking about the nationality.
Right.
You're not going to be talking about race, ethnicity.
Right.
You'll be saying, you know, I'm Rwandan or I'm Congolese or I come from South Africa. And so whatever they share beyond that, that's pertaining to, but if you're in London and you meet somebody who, for example, is Bangladeshi, and I say, and I'm speaking with them and they're like, where are you from? I'm from London. And then, no, where are you from? And immediately they will be on guard, maybe not in every case, but many times will be, wait a minute, are you asking about my heritage? So it's just about that sensitivity because, again, it's that perpetual you don't belong.
Right.
And when we focus on inclusion, we want people to feel they belong over time. And with that sensitivity and that curiosity, you can ask, how do you identify? And it won't be received necessarily in a wrong way.
Okay. You know, we'll go through the other things as well. You know, so my father had an anglicized name given to him when he was working because he had a Chinese name, right? And, you know, looking back now, this was so wrong, right? And it was just because his superiors couldn't pronounce his name, right? And why is, yeah, I grew up in the country, which is a British protectorate. So he was working for an oil company. And so his bosses were white. And I don't think they was a different time, right? And I don't think they meant it in a vicious way, but it's still so wrong, right?
It is. And now here, I'm not, there are many people who may have an anglicized name that they chose it or they're,
themselves.
I mean, maybe later in life or that they personally chose or that their parents gave them.
Right.
But looking, you know, to your question, it is wrong in the sense that it is like dishonoring his name.
Right.
And so sometimes the most powerful thing you can do is say somebody's name.
Right.
Because you're, you know, if you're in a meeting, if you're in writing an email, it seems very simple, but simply writing their name, saying their name.
Right.
And why this is so problematic, first of all, this is a microaggression, but there's nothing micro about it, is basically saying, I want to make myself more comfortable, so I'm going to give you a name I feel comfortable saying, and you just kind of whitewashed it there. It's crazy. I don't even know if that's appropriate to say that, but it's really shocking.
Right.
And so your feelings about it, I would share the same feeling.
Right. But it's just like me, like, I can't pronounce your name. I'll just call you Joe. Right. Okay.
Exactly.
You know,
I mean, I have a colleague, and I don't want to say her name because this is her story to share.
Right.
But she had a manager who changed her name because he could not pronounce her name and changed it. Said, I'm going to call you this.
Wow.
And it's a total microaggression. And that's why I say it's nothing micro about it.
Right.
And so one thing, if you're somebody who's done this, you really want to ask yourself, what am I making myself feel? Why am I making, why am I doing this? And who am I doing it for? And usually it's to make yourself feel comfortable.
Right.
And what we say is we want you to get uncomfortable and get comfortable with being uncomfortable.
Right.
We
want
you, if you can't pronounce somebody's name, we want you to get a tutor to help you pronounce the name. It matters that much that you acknowledge how I've seen it. It can, and if you have to constantly ask, you must do that. But if you can't grasp it, then you need to do additional homework on your own. You can't sit there and expect the person to constantly educate you on how to pronounce their name. But in the beginning, you can say, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I want to get this right. And people will be open to that for a certain time frame.
Right.
So, yeah,
you basically,
I'm sorry your dad had that experience.
and I don't think, you know, like you don't realize it, but you've basically taken away a person's identity and
exactly.
Right. Okay. Yeah. You know, this is just, you know, we're just basically warming up. Let's go to race and religion now. Okay.
Yeah.
What are some landmines when it comes to race? If we say, you know, like, you know, some companies say, well, race is not an issue in the company. Is that the right thing to say? And the context, I guess, where the company is coming from is that, you know, we hire based on meritocracy, so it's not about race. So is that the right thing to say?
Yeah. Well, first of all, no.
Okay.
So that's the short answer.
Right.
When companies say race is not an issue in this company, how do you know?
Right.
I mean, you know, so race, ethnicity can be defined in many ways. And oftentimes when I hear that or I hear we're a meritocracy, the warning bells go off in my head because it's almost like, again, if there's a theme in our conversation today. Who are we making this comfortable for?
Right.
How do we know? Do we really know it's not an issue? Can we say, and I would replace company with country, you know, because we hear this a lot. Well, this is especially after the murder of George Floyd, we heard, I heard it a lot in Europe. I would hear probably for about 3 to 4 weeks. I heard, but that's a U.S. issue. And I'm like, first of all, you're a global company, but let's also look at in your context. So race and ethnicity, you have to look in your context and see how is this playing out within your context? Who is marginalized in your context? Who is experiencing the company or the country in a way with that's tied to race, ethnicity, that others are not? So whoever is the dominant group, so I'll use in Europe, Europe is usually predominantly, you know, the dominant groups are usually white.
Right.
And so when I hear this example, such as it's not an issue in this country or this company, I understand that oftentimes what's underlying that is people don't want to see it or they want to justify and say, well, sure, it's not the same as another country. We're not saying that, but we want you to get curious about how a group might be marginalized in your country. So when it comes to saying those statements, it's like one thing I hear a lot, and this it usually comes like this, and it's usually well-intended, but we'll come to that intention versus impact in a moment.
Right.
But I usually hear, I don't see race. I don't see gender. I just care that you're the best. I just hire for the best person.
Right.
Now, that's wonderful that you have that intention. And that's how it is. But the reality is, when you say, I don't see, for example, the color of somebody's skin, that's an illusion. Mm. You do see it. Mm. And for you to say you don't see it is denying something.
Right.
It doesn't mean you're racist.
Right.
If you see somebody's race or ethnicity, that's not what we're saying. But what we're saying is when we try to make everybody the same and we try to say, I don't care if you're this, that, or that, what we're doing is we're doing a form of making everybody like us. Mm. So whatever the dominant group is, we don't have to see the difference. We don't have to see that there's a challenge. I live in Switzerland and I see how, you know, I have to look and see how is one group, for example, the Albanians, how are they being treated? Mm. Or in Europe, the Romani, the colloquial term is the Roma,
right.
How are they being treated? They are one of the most marginalized groups.
Right.
In Europe.
Right.
And so it's really getting curious there and finding out what is it I might be missing? Mm. What is it I may not be seeing? And maybe ask questions. And maybe you do a survey and find out that people don't feel it. People feel it's not an issue. That's wonderful. Mm. But you just can't take a blanket statement because for people who do experience it, they will feel unseen. They will feel that there's not acknowledgement, that they experience the workplace differently. And it can be quite negative experience for them.
Right. Moving on from race to religion, right? Should we just avoid talking about it in the workplace? You know, does it have a place in the workplace?
I don't think it's something that you can make a blanket statement on.
Right.
So in some parts of the world, you know, you have an obligation to make a reasonable effort to accommodate, you know, different faiths in the workplace.
Right.
And so it could be, you know, having holidays that recognize certain faiths and religions.
Right.
And I don't think there's a blanket statement. I also know in some parts of the world, they track religious diversity because they maybe don't have that religious diversity. And so the short answer is, I don't think you can say, should we avoid it? I would be careful in asking somebody about their religion unless you really, you know, I would be very cautious. You wouldn't want to out anybody or be there and say something. And again, in certain parts of the world, it can be very dangerous to be talking about that. And so my short answer is there isn't one answer to this.
Right.
But you do have to make a reasonable effort to accommodate, you know, for example, your team members' faith traditions in the workplace. It doesn't mean that they have the right, though, to push their religious views on their teammates or that the company has a right to do that in any way, shape or form. But it's just recognizing that we all make a beautiful mosaic in the world of all our differences, all our different beliefs and religions. And this should be seen as part of what makes
a celebration.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
It really should be. I mean, this is what makes life so interesting and special. And what makes people special as well, if they identify with something and they feel passionate about that, you know, that, yeah, let's celebrate the differences. And yet let's not make the differences be all that that person is.
Right.
You know, let's not have a stereotype or a bias about those differences.
Right. There's a lot that we have gone through today, and there's a lot more I need to go through with Catalyst and definitely arrange another time. But I guess a final question, what are some actions that organizations can take to ensure cultural diversity and sensitivity are looked into?
Yeah, there are a number of things you can do. I mean, first have conversations and you don't need, you know, a workshop to do that. You can have conversations on your teams. You can, with just a colleague over lunch, you know, start to normalize having conversations. You know, you want to dialogue. You don't want to debate. If you have to debate, this means somebody wins and somebody loses. So how can we instead get curious? How can we listen to others' experiences and their life and hear about them and appreciate it without having to come to any conclusions about anybody. And another thing, some actions that I've seen organizations take besides the dialogue and the conversation is they've looked into what are some microaggressions that people are experiencing in their culture and globally as well, and get curious about that. Because many times, again, what stops us from talking is we're afraid we're going to say the wrong thing. But if we talk about it, then we'll be aware, oh, that isn't problematic, but that is. And truly, you really want, many people want to do the right thing. I could not work so long in this space if I didn't have that as, for me at least, something I believe in. And it's usually the fear that creates most of the problems. And so the more we can normalize dialogue, and if you don't know what to say, listen. Just ask a question and listen and listen and learn. And it's not about having all the answers, but definitely about getting curious about your organization, your colleagues, and just in general, the people you work with and your customers. And just having that sensitivity can really build a lot of bridges.
We've been talking about cultural sensitivity in global workplaces. I've been speaking to Alison Zimmerman from Catalyst.org. And of course, as part of that, Flip That Script, which is something that you can find on their website. And I'm sure there'll be many other scripts that we need to flip. I'll be in touch again, Alison. It's been a pleasure. You've been listening to Enterprise, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.